Let me start by saying that in many areas I agree with Michael Tsarian, and not just in the existence of the New World Order, but also that history, especially ancient history, is nothing like we have been told in our classrooms, and it is in fact so strange that few would believe it if you outright proved it to them. I will attempt to show you that Tsarian is wrong, and that the views he promotes are indistinguishable from the Freemasonic, Theosophic, Luciferian views that I will demonstrate to be false. I will also show that there is an attempt to indoctrinate those who are awake into this version of history as quickly as possible, for a specific reason. I also want you to know that I will not be debunking him because I think his version of history or anything else is too strange, but rather because, as I will demonstrate, he is at best factually inaccurate, and at worst, lying. I am going to discuss a lot of things in this presentation, but I will end it with a review of Tsarian science regarding 2012. If you see nothing else of this video, skip forward to that section. Let's start by showing some of the tactics that Tsarian uses, so we know what to look for as we progress. It seems to be a type of mind control. For instance, notice the pictures he is placing behind the text here of alien ships beaming down the Bible. Now listen to the verse he is using to prove his point.
Being taken from Atlantis over to Lemuria, the myths suggest that they were taken by spacecraft. Here in Numbers 9, we read, "And when the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle, then after that the children of Israel journeyed, and in the place where the cloud abode, there the children of Israel pitched their tents."
Now I want you to believe that when it says, "in the place where the cloud abode," means that they were taken up into the clouds, outer space or symbolic for another planet. He also suggests that when it says, "after that they journeyed in the place where the cloud abode," means that they went away on an interplanetary journey. I'm going to read the rest of this passage from the Bible, and notice what is being said would be very hard to take as symbolism for being taken up into the clouds, or earth women being taken on a journey on or in the clouds. It only works because he quotes such a small section of it, and after he has already told you the backstory that he wants you to believe, not to mention putting pictures of spaceships beaming down Bibles in the background. "And when the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle, then after that the children of Israel journeyed, and in the place where the cloud abode, there the children of Israel pitched their tents. At the commandment of the Lord, the children of Israel journeyed, and at the commandment of the Lord they pitched. As long as the cloud abode upon the tabernacle, they rested in their tents. And when the cloud tarried long upon the tabernacle many days, then the children of Israel kept the charge of the Lord, and journeyed not. And so it was, when the cloud was a few days upon the tabernacle, according to the commandment of the Lord, they abode in their tents, and according to the commandment of the Lord, they journeyed. And so it was, when the cloud abode from even until morning, and that the cloud was taken up in the morning, then they journeyed. Whether it was by day or by night, when the cloud was taken up, they journeyed. Or whether it were 2 days, or a month, or a year, that the cloud tarried upon the tabernacle, remaining thereon, the children of Israel abode in their tents, and journeyed not. But when it was taken up, they journeyed." The text reiterates that the cloud was leading them through the desert, not that people were taken up into the clouds at all. Another example of this particular type of Tsarian's tactics is in the next clip, where Tsarian is speaking to women. He is telling them that the Bible, which was written by evil aliens who hate us, according to him, really hate women. He is reading a passage from the Bible where God is speaking to the serpent, not to the woman, who God speaks to in the next verse, which Tsarian doesn't quote. Yet Tsarian goes right along as if God were condemning women. And again, to drive his point home, he uses this picture of an angel condemning a woman in the background.
But again, Genesis 3, the Bible, the Judeo-Christian manifesto, talks about the utter wrath, the utter ire of the Atlanteans and their progeny towards the females. This was a crime that they had committed 30, 50,000 years ago that would never be forgotten. Genesis says, "Because thou hast done this, thou art cursed above all cattle and above every beast of the field. Upon thy belly thou wilt go, and dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life." I mean, clearly anybody with two brain cells can see that merely eating an apple off of a tree could hardly merit this kind of wrath. We have a very imbalanced story here. I mean, the whole story of Eve creating the fall is so ludicrous. as to not even want to be mentioned? Why would the Lord God not respond with compassion or love or forgiveness?
And just in case anyone says, well, maybe he is thinking that the serpent represents the female, a theme he tries to present just before this. But this would contradict his own theory, which is that the serpent represents the Lemurians, and the Lemurians were offering Eve the apple, or trying to get Eve to come with them to their planet to be rejuvenated and re-educated. You just can't have it both ways. And furthermore, right after God condemns the serpent, if God were really talking to women there, why does he then turn to Eve and talk to her about it? Are we to believe that the true symbolism of the Bible is that the serpent and Eve represent Eve? As I said, it's not even consistent with his own version of the story. It can only be chalked up in my mind to a man deliberately taking the Bible out of context for some agenda. That agenda so far seems to be focused on getting people to dislike God in the Bible.
Of the Lord, and by his fierce anger. So there we have those qualities again. We got God, and we've got his fierce anger, his fierce wrath.
I want to continue a bit longer with some of his tactics before moving on to other things. The next one is one of the oldest Masonic tricks in the book. It's the old sounds-like game. Jordan Maxwell has confused a generation of truth-seekers with this one, and while Tsaring is much better at it than Maxwell, he still desperately is hoping that there is no linguists in the audience.
But what is the meaning of this word, the Ankh? Often we're told that it just is a symbol for life, or the symbol of breath, or the symbol of the coming together of the opposite sexes. But again, the word itself contains the meaning. If you replace the vowels to this ancient word, it actually spells out the word Anunnaki, which, as we saw earlier, means the Nephilim. So Ankh becomes the Anunnaki, or the Ananaje, heavenly serpents. So any time from now on where you see a god holding in their right hand the Ankh, all that is telling you is that we are the ones from up there. We are the ones from the heavens who came to earth.
Egyptian and Sumerian are two different languages, and completely unrelated in this regard. Egyptian is in the Afro-Asiatic family. Sumerian isn't in any family, according to linguists. There is no actual etymological connection here. According to one linguist, Tsaring's assertion here is a, quote, sound similar, must to be a relationship buffoonery, end quote. Not to mention that he has to just add what he says are vowels to this word to make it work, even though two of them aren't vowels at all, and that there was a vowel in the original word. And of course, Anunnaki doesn't mean heavenly serpents. But if you prefer Zachariah Sitchin's translation of this and the word Nephilim, I suggest you take a look at the website sitchinisWrong.com and see that Sitchin makes up almost as much as Tsaring. He does something similar in the next clip. Notice the step-by-step way he changes the word Nazareth to Nazirius.
Now, we've all heard of Jesus of Nazareth, of course. Jesus from Nazareth. The only trouble is there is no such place as Nazareth. There never has been a place called Nazareth. And no map of any age ever shows us the location or place of Nazareth. The word, in fact, derives from the Egyptian Nazir, meaning prince who is sent, and also from Nasir, meaning Sirius, the star Sirius. So it is really Jesus of Nasirius. Furthermore, the word carpenter, or Jesus was a carpenter, remember? Well, the word carpenter comes from the Semitic Nagar, which means serpent priests.
Lots of problems here. First, on the assertion that Nazareth never existed. I have heard people say that Nazareth was invented in the 4th century, but I've never understood how one could believe it, because whether you trust them or not, the biblical texts do date back to the early part of the 1st century. Even the skeptic scholars don't try to push the Gospels much past 100 AD. So you have the accounts of this small town in Nazareth in those texts, not to mention also in the Talmud, which is also in the 1st century, which obviously doesn't support the idea of Jesus being the Messiah at all, and would have no reason to validate this story. In fact, they were clearly looking for holes in the story. But it mentions Jesus, and in the context of trying to explain away his miracles as parlor tricks. So the question is, why didn't anyone just say the Gospels had made up a town called Nazareth? There was a window of a few hundred years where skeptics of the day had a chance to say, these Gospels have gone and made up a town, and they would have been in a much better position to know if the town had existed or not, being locals. On this point, it seems that Tsaring is simply using the stated fact that Nazareth was little more than an outpost of a town, and using it as proof that it didn't exist. Moving on. Nazir and Nazi have different consonants. He gives no reason to jump from one to the other, but it's obvious he needs to get there somehow to make it sound like Sirius. Not to mention, Sirius doesn't mean serpent. Sirius comes from the Greek Sirios, which means scorcher. The rise of Sirius was in the season of greatest heat, summer. It's close to the spelling Sireios, which means twisted. But again, there are two different words, and none of them match up with Tessarion's definition. The word for carpenter in the New Testament is tekton. In the Aramaic, it's nagar, which can mean craftsman, or possibly even scholar. I can find no good reason why Tessarion is saying that the Aramaic word nagar means serpent priests. Again, this shows that he has a specific target in these deceptions.
Now, Madame Blavatsky, one of the greatest scholars the world has ever known, writes in this way. She says, the appellation Satan in Hebrew belongs by right to the first and cruelest adversary of all other gods, Jehovah, not in the serpent which spoke only words of sympathy and wisdom.
Now, even if we accept any variation of Lucifer symbolism, in this quote, it's clear that Tessarion agrees with Blavatsky, the greatest scholar the world has ever known, that what we call God should be called Satan, and the serpent is actually our good friend. In this case, he wants us to think that the serpent represents the Lemurians, not women. Lemurians, by the way, is a word that entered into our lexicon through Helena Blavatsky. I would also offer a definition of Luciferianism, which is, Luciferianism can be understood best as a belief system that venerates the essential characteristics that are affixed to Lucifer. I'm not asking you to apply any religious ideas to his assertion that God is Satan and that Lucifer is good. I just want to show you how, by any definition, Tessarion is a Luciferian, regardless of what he tells you that minute that the serpent represents. I will now show you a clip that will reiterate this assertion in a way that is not immediately obvious.
The spiritual beings he's referring to are known in Latin as the Cosmocrates, or the Angeli Motivori, the angelic beings. He says the leader of these mighty beings was due to take over the direction of Western civilization in 1881. This caused considerable excitement in the esoteric circles of Washington, D.C., and the occult world in general. So now we hear that there's a hierarchy of these beings, there's a leader of these beings, and theosophists know what this means. It reminds us of Steiner and his work on the concept of Michael and Ahriman.
Not only does Tessarion identify himself with theosophists here, which is no surprise because of his deep reverence for its founder, H.P. Blavatsky, but what is interesting is his reference to Steiner, because Rudolf Steiner believed that Michael and Ahriman were two aspects of the leader of the angels, Lucifer, who gave knowledge to mankind, according to him, and who now resides in the sun. Now, if there is a better example of Tessarion showing his core beliefs to be Masonic and Luciferian and a part of the mystery schools and not just exposing them, I'd like to hear it. But the real disturbing thing here is this weird doublespeak that I know his followers have noticed, which is that he spends so little time on these angels or macrobes and focuses mainly on the alien oppressors. But when he does talk about them, it's clear on the one hand he thinks that they are really what's behind all the bloodshed and wars. But then, in another place, he tells you that the leader of these angels deserves the throne of God much more than God does. It just doesn't make any sense. I want to continue to show you some of Tessarion's beliefs and how they are Masonic to the core, right down to his hope for reducing the population and a dislike of the idea of man as the head of the family and getting rid of all borders and national sovereignty. He will go through a list of things that he implies came into the world through the idea of the Hebrew God in the Bible. He also throws in some obviously bad ideas that I guess he wants you to think that God likes.
We have culture based on acquired inheritance. We have walled cities, enclosed cities. We have the domestication of animals. We have meat diet. We have the family organization now, with the male at the head. We have the phenomenon of overpopulation.
Even the idea of suggesting that in a utopia, no one would eat meat is interesting to me, because in the Bible, it makes a vivid description of what the New World Order system will look like, and oddly, Tessarion's hope for humanity is close to what we see presented here. In 1 Timothy 4, verse 1, it says, "Now the Spirit speaketh expressly, that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils, speaking lies in hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry, and commanding to abstain from meats. There will, according to the Bible, be a prohibition of eating meat and a prohibition from the standard family unit. These are two examples of Tassarian's desires for the world, matching up exactly as the overlords he claims to expose. Here's some more examples of Tassarian subtly indoctrinating people into Freemasonic thought.
Well, the great geomanticists of the world understood that there's a feng shui of the earth as well. What happens if you want to suppress some good energy that's flowing? Put an obelisk there, put a statue, put a hideous piece of modern art. That'll do the trick, all right. And what happens if you're a decent individual and you're aware of spiritual earth energy and you want to conduct powerful vortexes of energy? Same thing, you can put a statue or an obelisk or a round circle or a stone circle there to help to transmute and transmit that energy.
One of the ancient structures that could be used in this revivification process is the Great Pyramid at Giza. It was known by those who've made a study of the principles of the pyramid and its construction and its interior, know that it was used for healing and used for reconstitution of the body, and that certain monatomic substances were taken within its precinct, and that it generates certain kinds of energy and frequencies.
Most of what Tassarian says revolves around the idea that a prehistoric alien race genetically altered humanity, and as a result, we humans are half evil because of that trauma. Tassarian uses a very interesting tactic when speaking of this backstory. I will show you that when he is regaling us with the specifics of Lemuria and Atlantis, he never cites or even tries to cite references, which is amazing considering the very intricate details that he is proposing. Have you ever wondered how he is so confident in a history that the details of which even Plato was decidedly sketchy on? Let's listen to him spin a tale of ancient history, and ask yourself, where is he getting this information from, and why does he seem so much like a used car salesman in these next clips?
Now, the alien geneticists did not desire a repeat of their first experiments. They realized that the error centered on the intelligence of their progeny. In the Mark II experiment, Adamic man's intelligence would be confounded. Well, that's right. What was the reason why your first progeny just up and left and stopped serving you? It's because, of course, they're turned on mentally. They're intelligent. They can work out that they're being used for slaves and perhaps don't want to do some of the menial tasks. And they're thinking, why should we, with all of our capacities, and perhaps even with this other capacity that they don't have? And when it finally became known to them, you see, that another race had been created, they had a bit of a dilemma. Because one thing that the Lemurians, the sons of the serpent, the Mark I progeny, and the Adamic Mark II progeny have in common is, of course, the human DNA. And they had the alien DNA. But on Lemuria, the idea would have been to condition the alien proclivities out, or to rarefy them, so at least they were contributing to the development of mankind. But the Atlanteans, who are the master geneticists, and it's habitual to them to be dealing in genetics, they decide to make yet again another slave race, another race that will be able to serve them and carry out their bidding. However, this time, they decide not to go to the human species at all, because they're sick and tired of that. They thought, every time we've done that, it's never worked out. But there are other life forms on the planet Earth. There's lots of fauna. And so they were making genetic profiles of the fauna. And specifically, they discovered that the DNA of the reptile, the humble Earth reptile, crossed well with their own alien DNA. And when they got to Atlantis, when they got out of Atlantis and went to Lemuria, that's exactly what happened. The Lemurian masters there, the sons of the serpent, awoken the Adams and Eves gradually, slowly, and possibly even worked with their DNA to awaken the DNA and the parts of their biology and their chemistry that had also been suppressed. Now, John Dee was one of the most powerful black magicians in history. He decided it would be better to contact pan-dimensional intelligences to solve their little problem of quarantine. Via his system of magic and divination, he succeeded in opening a portal to these fourth-dimensional entities, or oversouls.
Dee became what might be described as a living macroscope. This was not the first time in Earth history where such a forbidden rite was undertaken. Every time it occurs, it has the severest repercussions for history. The only instrument by which we can see them or contact the macrobes is human intuition, human imagination, the clairvoyant abilities which John Dee, Meister Dee, and his cohorts were working with. John Dee's mind was nearly frazzled by his communications, his astral communications with these strange overworld pan-dimensional beings. But he also was to find out that the macrobes don't work for free. Yes, they had the answers to the problem of the Stargate. But you see, they don't work for free. You have to pay them. And when John Dee entered into this giant pact, he was to find this out. And he was also to find out what the macrobes would want in return for the knowledge they were giving him. And what they wanted was blood. We are aware that the place and the location and the timing are very important. And the letting of blood is very important. Well, if you're dealing on a ritual level as large as what Sir John Dee was dealing with, we also need a vast quantity of sacrificial victims and blood.
Clearly, if he believes this to be true, then it would not be the alien overlords that are the root of the problem, but it would be these spiritual beings that are much smarter and much more bloodthirsty, and in fact are, by his definition, the sole reason for all the wars of recent times. And this is one area that I agree with Tsarian on. I believe that there are these macrobes, and that by contacting them, we are giving them access to our dimension, and that they require things like blood. I disagree with Tsarian that we should practice these things like Enochian magic. Tsarian runs a mystery school in which he apparently teaches people to do different types of divination and other types of ritual. I say that this is what we must not do. Tsarian says that it is by magic ritual that these entities are gaining access to our dimension, and it is by them gaining access into our dimension that are causing all the troubles that we are facing. So by logical deduction, we must not practice magic rituals. And once they do gain access to this dimension, there is only one way to get them out, and Tsarian certainly is not teaching that. But when you take into account that he believes, like Helena Blavatsky and Rudolf Steiner, that Lucifer, the leader of these macrobes, is very good, then things tend to get a little foggy. Regarding 2012, Tsarian's main thesis on the issue is that a galactic alignment, of which kind he doesn't seem sure, and a passing through a certain photon belt is going to cause an enlightenment in the human race, and as a result, a lot of people who weren't ready for this enlightenment are going to have to be dealt with in some way. I shudder to think how. I will show that Tsarian is wrong about every aspect of 2012 in ways that can only be chalked up to either terrible research or, at worst, intentional deception. Before we get started on the 2012 theories, I want to play a clip from my video 2012 Debunked to show you the difference between the 26,000-year precession cycle and the 250-million-year cycle of the solar system's revolution around the galaxy, because it's going to help you see right through most of what we're about to see and hear. This event is only significant from the Earth's point of view. The precession cycle, or the roughly 26,000-year wobble of the Earth, only causes the effect of the stars changing position on the horizon, and therefore only the effect of a galactic alignment. If you were viewing this from anywhere else in the solar system, it would be totally insignificant. This is only a visual effect, and only from the Earth's perspective. And no gravitational force or radiation can be expected from this event, because other than the tilt of the Earth, nothing will be any different than the last few thousand solstices. We will be no closer to galactic center on that day than on any other day. The other camp of the 2012 alignment issue is probably the more significant one, because it's dealing with the solar system's actual location in relation to galactic center. The idea is that our little solar system is moving around the center of the galaxy every 225 to 250 million years or so. And while doing this, it's also moving up and down in a cycle crossing the middle of the plane every 33 million years. So, the question is, are we going to cross that galactic plane in 2012? Not even close. According to the journal Nature and others, there is evidence of crossing this plane 3 million years ago. This would mean that we are moving away from the galactic plane and won't be due to cross for another 30 million years.
We all know about light. Well, the highest form of light that can manifest physically is photonic. Photonics is discharge from the movement of the electron on an atomic level. And there is purported to be a large belt of photonic energy that every period of a certain age will come, in which the whole, not just the planet, but the whole solar system will pass through, almost like a car wash. The whole solar system moving through a high radiation band of photonic energy. And if this is the case, this could be one of the reasons it's precipitating the acceleration, the speed, the need of the progeny of the Atlanteans to vacate the planet. Because photonic energy has certain principles. From Barbara Hahn Clough's book, The Pleiadian Agenda, we find that Robert Stanley, who reported on the discovery of the photon band by satellites in 1991, and he commented, "These excesses of photons are being emitted from the center of our galaxy. Our solar system enters the area of our galaxy every 11,000 years and then passes through for 2,000 years while completing its 26,000-year galactic orbit." Now, the photon effect is caused by the precession of our solar system and its accompanying planets around the central sun called Alcyon, located in the constellation of the Pleiades. This counterclockwise cyclic precession around Alcyon requires about 25,860 years to make one complete orbit. Our present-day sun, moon, and planets must twice pass through the photon belt during this time. That is, once to the north and once to the south. During this cycle, there are two periods of darkness and two periods of light. The periods of darkness, which constitute the vast majority of the rotation around the central sun, consist of two periods of about 10,500 years. Following each period of 10,500 years of darkness, then we emerge into 2,000 years of total light, which actually constitutes the photon belt. Simply put, we have a cycle lasting about 26,000 years. And for most of this cycle, we're, as we are now, in a period of darkness.
He confuses the solar system's 250 million year circuit around the galaxy with the 26,000 year precession cycle. He then tells us that there is a certain photon belt that we pass through as a part of the solar system's circle around the galaxy. But again, he thinks this circle around the galaxy takes a few hundred million years less time than it actually does. He says it takes 26,000 years. Keep in mind, the 26,000-year precession cycle is just the Earth wobbling on its axis. It isn't passing through anything. It's just tilting in different directions. To say we're going to pass through a nebula as a part of that cycle is lacking a very basic understanding of astronomy or a will to deceive. The photon belt idea is not something you will find a whole lot of science on. It is mostly from New Age authors who generally couple the idea with vague notions about how our DNA is going to be changed when we pass through it. Some parts of the story can be analyzed scientifically, however, and there is no scientific evidence for the existence of any sort of photon belt. Here's why. A photon is an elementary particle that makes up light. It would require the gravitational pull of a black hole, with light rays being bent around the black hole near the event horizon, forming a photon sphere. Barring interaction with gravity or matter, photons otherwise always travel in straight lines. Tsarian keeps showing us a picture of a nebula and saying it's going to be a cloud of very powerful chakra morphing DNA splitting photons. But you can't get a photon to stay put in a nebula, especially one that's supposed to be there every 26,000 years, let alone 250 million years. But there are several more good reasons to prove that this is untrue and deceitful. He implies that Alcyon is the central sun in which the solar system and everything else in the galaxy revolves around. But Alcyon is a star in the Pleiades cluster. This was probably mentioned because most occult writers who talk about a world order causing photon belt say that it's in the Pleiades system, and they also say that we're heading right for it. But that system is some 440 light-years away, and the Sun, with the Earth, is moving away from Alcyon. We should listen a little more when he says to do our homework.
And he's talking more here about spiritual darkness again. We then emerge into 2,000 years of total light, which actually constitutes the photon belt. We then have 21,860 years of darkness, and 4,000 years of light if you take it together. Another way of viewing this phenomenon is that In one complete orbit, we have 5/6 darkness and approximately 1/6 light, or a 5-to-1 ratio, with darkness being predominant.
This is another example of the intent to keep telling people that there is an illumination coming. Here he is quoting someone who is saying that the 26,000-year precession of the equinoxes is not only tied to the photon belt, which of course is impossible, but he also says the photon belt is related to our spiritual enlightenment, again with no reason to believe that. In a minute I will show you why this is important for the New World Order system.
Now there are also corresponding cycles of importance to take into consideration. Stephen Hanawar mentioned some of these. He says that Nick Fiorenza has determined that the Earth and the Sun will be aligning with the center of the galaxy sometime between 1999 and 2000. The equatorial plane of the Earth, known as the ecliptic, aligns with the ecliptic of the Sun at the same time that they both align with the ecliptic of the galactic core. This unique alignment occurs only 4 times during the precession of the equinox cycle, corresponding with the 4 corners of the world. The last configuration similar to this upcoming alignment corresponds to around 9500 BC. He believes that there will be another major Earth changes as the time of the sinking of Atlantis and the Great Flood, but with one addition, that being a possible dimension shift.
This is some of the worst science yet. Now keep in mind, this time he's talking about the solar system's up and down movement as it circles the galaxy, which takes about 250 million years. Now he says that during this orbit, the solar system will align with galactic plane in 2000. This is already wrong according to the Journal of Nature, which states that we crossed this plane 3 million years ago, and aren't due to return for another 30 million years. So not only is he wrong about predicting this would happen in the year 2000, only 30 million years off, but Tesarian is promoting the idea that this alignment happens 4 times in 26,000 years. So, recapping, real science says this happens once in 33 million years. Tesarian says it happens 4 times in 26,000 years. This isn't the first time Tesarian contradicts himself about what specifically is going to make us illuminated.
Now, John Major Jenkins, in his book Maya Cosmogenesis, the Maya were aware of our solstice sun's impending alignment with galactic plane and galactic center, an astronomical alignment that occurs only once every 13,000 years. I have honestly documented my encounter with this idea and have gone deep into the academic literature to decode how this end date alignment scenario, what I call the galactic cosmology, was incorporated into basic Maya institutions such as the ball game, the king ascension rites, and the Maya creation myth. This amazing fact that ancient Mesoamerican sky watchers were able to pinpoint a winter solstice far off into the future has not been dealt with by Mayanists. And why did they choose the year 2012? One immediately gets the impression that there is a very strange mystery to be confronted here. Why did early Mesoamerican sky watchers pick a date some 2,300 years into the future? And in fact, how did they pinpoint an accurate winter solstice? With all these considerations, one begins to suspect that for some reason the ancient New World astronomers were tracking precession. So John Major Jenkins asks a bunch of questions here, the age-old questions about how did they know they lived years ago.
So John Major Jenkins and Michael Tesarian are absolutely baffled about how the Mayans knew about precession. Well, let me see if I can take a stab at it. This is a very common tactic to give people the idea that the Mayans were doing something mysterious and magical. But the Greeks had already discovered the wobble of the Earth well before the Mayan calendar was even invented. It was a matter of mathematics and astronomical observations. The Mayans were around for hundreds of years, and they obviously kept records, so it's entirely possible for, say, a Mayan astronomer to plot the position of some stars at midnight at the equinox, and his grandson to plot the same stars 72 years later, and realize that the stars had all shifted 1 degree in that time. Multiply by 360 and you get the precession cycle of 26,000 years. Almost certainly this is how they did it, because that's all it takes. You could set a clock by it, and they did. And so did the Greeks.
Now Stephen Hanawar goes on to say the Maya calendar is the only calendar known to be based on galactic cycles. The Mayans claimed they created this calendar in order to monitor the light coming from the center of the galaxy and how it affected our DNA.
Why does he keep quoting from this guy? As we have shown, the Mayan calendar is not based at all on galactic cycles. It's based on the changing view of the stars from the Earth's perspective called precession. To say that it is based on galactic cycles is just wrong. But to say that the calendar was to monitor light coming from the center of the galaxy and how it affected our DNA is possibly the biggest whopper yet. Tessarian or anyone else wouldn't dare to show you how the Mayan calendar monitored DNA. He only quotes from this individual because it agrees with his unbelievably flimsy idea that a photon belt is going to somehow, some way, enlighten us. Never mind that photons don't gather in belts, or that we're moving away from where it's supposed to be.
Earth's background base frequency, or heartbeat, called the Schumann resonance, or SR, is rising dramatically. Though it varies among geographical regions, for decades the overall measurement was 7.8 cycles per second. This was once thought to be a constant. Recent reports set the rate at over 11 cycles and climbing. Science doesn't know why or what to make of it. Well, Wilhelm Reich would be asserting that it's these changes in consciousness.
The Schumann resonance. He says that it was once thought to be static, and that it is now growing more intense, and that no one knows what to make of it. This is very wrong. The Schumann resonance was mathematically predicted before it was even observed. And it was never thought to be static, because even from the earliest days they understood that it was changed dramatically by lightning and by other factors. To say that it is rising and no one knows why leaves out the most obvious and well-understood cause, but it's a clear case of fear-mongering to get people to think this is more evidence of a coming change that Tessarian has yet to establish a real reason to expect.
Now, the collapse of the Earth's magnetic field, which both guards the planet and guides many of its creatures, appears to have started in earnest about 150 years ago, the New York Times is planning to report. Science reporter Bill Broad has filed a report which explores how the field strength has waned 10% to 15% so far, and this deterioration has accelerated of late, increasing debate over whether it portends a reversal of the lines of magnetic force that normally envelop the Earth.
This has always been a strange thing to say to me. And keep in mind, I used to say it when I was a 2012-er. I used to tell people that there was a magnetic pole reversal coming in 2012. I wasn't sure if it was going to be because of galactic alignment or solar flares, but I knew it was going to be in 2012. Well, do a little math with me, and if it began 150 years ago, and we are presently only 10 to 15% through, why would you expect it to change significantly in the next 3 years, to the point of equating this event with the year 2012 at all?
Some observers say this alignment with the heart of the galaxy in 2012 will open a channel for cosmic energy to flow through the Earth, cleansing it and all that dwells upon it, raising all to a higher level of vibration.
Did you catch how some observers claim that it's going to open a portal? It seems like they should give a reason why. But it's much more effective if you can blind someone with what looks and sounds like science while telling them that a channel to cosmic energy is going to happen in 2012. Giving them only a few vague notions on how this is supposed to happen. The New World Order has convinced us that their plan is just about the nuts and bolts of the police state system, cameras and ID chips. But the real agenda requires those who are close to understanding first to be prepared to accept the new false utopia. But it is the false utopia that they refer to when they say New World Order, not the build-up to it. And it will come on the heels of 2012 if they can get the idea to as many people as possible. It's really the only way to get the so-called truth seekers to be on board with a world government. Then people will willingly give up their weapons and their borders and their constitutions if they can be convinced that they're only part of an intergalactic race of people that are no longer subject to any god. Those that consider themselves renegades because they think that they've come to the conclusions they have about 2012 all on their own should consider why it has been so well propagated over the last few decades. Do you think that Sony Pictures would tell people all about it if it was the biggest secret the New World Order had to offer? There is another thing that a belief in a coming enlightenment will cause to happen, but we can get to that in a second. What I want you to notice about the following claims about this enlightenment is what is offered to prove that it is a valid idea. He even admits here he doesn't really understand what it is that's going to cause an enlightenment, just that it is going to happen.
Whether we're entering a belt of radiation or whether some other activity or movement or dynamic affects the electrons within our planet, within our atmosphere, within the atomic frequency, then there's photonic energy released. I mean, there's a speculation on exactly how these photonic particles will start to act and operate.
Now I want to move into something that I think is the most important part of the 2012 deception, and that is to get the world ready to purge themselves of the dirt.
That the end date of 2012 signals major changes positively for consciousness. But again, as I repeat, before you can have the light, or when you have bright light, the first thing you notice is the dirt.
So who or what is the dirt? I'll give you a few guesses.
Now, competent astrologers know that the negative traits associated with the sign of Pisces, this is the age that we've been in for over 2,000 years, concern deception, vice, hidden agendas, mass delusion, and the misuse of spiritual virtue and power. These are the negative traits we associate with the sign of Pisces. Every sign of the zodiac, just like every symbol and sign, has both positive and negative connotations. And these are the negative ones of Pisces. So in the age of Pisces, it was to be expected that the world would experience its share of these negatives on a macrocosmic level. As the age of Pisces comes to a close, the deceivers know that a paradigm shift which will occur does not favor their machinations. This understanding has led them to make many subtle alterations to their age-old stratagems.
That's right. It's Christianity, and it's got to go. Although he cleverly didn't say it outright there, there can be no doubt of what he wants the viewer to think. And I'm not defending the Catholic Church by any means. But he is also making it very clear that it's the concept of Christianity, not the Roman perversion of it, that has to go, which is very, very disturbing.
But what we can understand is that the ancients understood that the sun moves through the 12 signs of the zodiac very gradually backwards in the precession of the equinox, and that each time it moves into a different house, a new mythology is needed, a new set of symbols. In the age of Pisces, the mythographers, the powers that be, understand that we're coming to a cusp point and there's going to be a sizable shift. I mean, after all, in astrology, Pisces is a mutable water sign. Aquarius is a fixed air sign. There's going to be changes, quantum shifts in consciousness. And the powers that be, who know how to track these enormous epochal changes, understand that there's going to be a need to revise some of their own mythologies, and operating manuals, operating procedures will have to change. And the age of Aquarius is said to begin, nobody knows quite for sure, but they think it's to begin in AD 2740. However, as the sun moves towards the final degrees of the previous sign, the descendants of the great cults of power who are at the helm of the religions and governments need to make arrangements for that change. As each age terminates, the appointed mythographers have to get ready to script new mythologies consistent with the complex symbolism of the coming age.
In one sense, I agree with him that a new religion is in fact being constructed by the New World Order. I disagree with him because I think that the religion that is going to be used is the one that this salesman, Tessarian, is pitching to you right now. It's going to be one that is based on the idea that humanity was genetically engineered by an alien race, and that we are at a crucial juncture in this global society, one in which our new understanding of our origins will lead us to an illumination of global understanding and a willful elimination of national sovereignty, even by those that used to fight such notions. And in this new global utopia, there might be people who say things like, "Our Bible told us that this false peace was going to happen, and it said it would look just like this, and that it won't last but a few months before all hell breaks out." Those people need to be eliminated, because they aren't ready for this new global peace. They are too afraid of it. They are what's holding the world back from global peace. And after the genocide of those people, everyone will find out for the first time what the real agenda of the New World Order was. But at that point, for many, it will be much too late. I found the following to be a validation of my theory that this idea of eliminating the dirt is very important to Tessarian, because he added to this presentation something of an addendum after the credits had rolled. He apparently felt something hadn't been adequately presented and needed to be reiterated. He even thought it was important enough to add it even though the set and other details were changed. What was so important to reiterate?
The survivors are those who can adjust their consciousnesses and mentality to the inviolate movement of nature, and synchronize their psyches with the universal meta-theme, to having the fates conspire to augur in cataclysmic external and internal events in order to undermine the rotten edifice we stand worshipping and bring it crashing down around us. As this photonic light gradually intensifies, most people's consciousnesses are going to rebel, as we all do when a bright light is shined in our face. We turn away and cover our eyes. We may even strike out at those holding the light towards us. Those few who can face this light and who are prepared for it will be guided, given their healing, and able to live their dreams. But these few will have to be deeply able to understand what is happening to those around them in order to be defended against the worst effects of this irregular but radical change.
There you have it, a perfect setup. You know, I hear a lot of criticisms of the Bible, and I like to try to answer them if people have questions, because I find most of them to be easily answered, and I kind of like doing it. And if you have any, you can send them to an email address that you can find on my website. But there's one passage that I've secretly had a lot of trouble with, that I couldn't understand how it could happen in this politically correct, technologically advanced world we live in. It says that in the New World Order, people will rejoice in the killing of Christians, and that if they don't go along with the beast system, will be publicly executed. It wasn't until I really understood what was being said by the 2012 propaganda that it finally made sense. Just look around. How many of those truth movement teachers, especially those connected with theosophy, like Tessarian and Maxwell, that pushed 2012 also tell you that Christianity is the enemy and imply that it must be destroyed for humanity to survive? If you hate Christians and Judaism, there's a very good chance that you have been brainwashed by the real New World Order. It is not obvious to many people, sadly even to many Christians nowadays, that the core power of what Tessarian calls the macrobes and the power that they answer to is totally vulnerable to the authority of Jesus Christ. Exorcisms do not, as the Catholic Church would have you believe, require incense and holy water and all those other things. It only requires a stern word from a true Christian. This is the power that must first be marginalized and destroyed for the evil we fight to assert its control and place their phoenix on the throne of the infrastructure that has been built by the whispers to the ears of humans who have been deceived in opening doors that, despite the promises of power, only serve that realm.